This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton, and I'd like to welcome you once again to an episode of Night Transmissions. In this case, it's episode number 68. Night Transmissions is 2 hours of murder and mayhem, some science fiction, a little fantasy, mostly in the form of old radio shows, but I do throw in the occasional foray into pulp fiction. Just now and then, just ever so often, not so much that you're going to really notice it, a little poetry, even some literature, and, oh yeah, me. I will try to keep that to a minimum. I will try to avoid redundancy when I can. I mean, why should I give you a synopsis of a program that you're going to hear in just a few seconds? Speaking of which, tonight, the Man in Black shepherds in an episode of suspense from March the 23rd of 1943. I think three. Yeah, that's what it says, 1943. The customers like murder. I guess I should mention the fact that the sound file for this show is a little raspy, but it is, in my humble opinion, entirely listenable.
The Man in Black. Here again to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense. Our distinguished star this evening is that delightful gentleman, Mr. Roland Young, playing as author of detective novels, who invented his best plot when his life was at stake. With Mr. Young to play his long-suffering secretary is Miss Peggy Conklin. A story by John Dixon Carr, in a somewhat lighter mood than is our habit, and called The Customers Like Murder, is tonight's tale of suspense. If you've been with us on these Tuesday nights, you will know that suspense is compounded of mystery and suspicion and dangerous adventure. In this series are tales calculated to intrigue you, to stir your nerves, to offer you a precarious situation, and then withhold the solution until the last possible moment. And so with The Customers Like Murder and the performance of Roland Young, we again hope to keep you in suspense. On a hot summer night in a village on the east coast of England, a famous writer of detective stories is dictating to his secretary. You have all heard of Mr. Gerald Hawkstone, celebrated author of Murder on the Wolfhead, Aconite at the Admiralty, Who Shot the Prime Minister, and other thrillers which have held us past the midnight hour. You have followed the exploits of Pendleton Keene, diplomat detective. Gerald Hawkstone lives quietly at Deal with his friend Dr. Roberts nearby, in case he should need medical knowledge. And his pretty, if somewhat pert, Canadian secretary, Miss Patricia Phillips. Gerald Hawkstone would be a happy man, even in wartime, if it were not wartime.
You got all that, Miss Phillips?
Yes, Mr. Hawkstone.
Good. New paragraph?
Yes, Mr. Hawkstone.
At the head of the great banqueting table, comma, the Lord Chief Justice staggered to his feet, full stop. His face was a ghastly whitish color, and his eyes had become glassy.
Is he drunk, Mr. Hawkstone?
No, Miss Phillips, the Lord Chief Justice is not drunk.
Sounds pretty cockeyed to me.
For your information, Mr. Ripp, the Lord Chief Justice has just been poisoned with curare because he discovered the identity of the master criminal. Is that clear?
Yes, Mr. Hawkstone, but I wish you wouldn't do it.
Do what?
Well, in the last four books, Mr. Hawkstone, you have shot the Prime Minister, killed the Lord Chancellor with an axe, poisoned the Home Secretary, and blown up the First Lord of the Admiralty. Why don't you stop picking on the poor government and murder somebody else for a change?
The Lord Chancellor, Miss Phillips, was not murdered with an axe.
No, Mr. Hawkstone?
Definitely no. He was beamed with the Great Seal and found dead on the Wolfpack. And there's another thing, Miss Phillips. Whether you talk like this because of a dense vacuum in what we will charitably call your mind...
Really, Hoxton?
Or whether you are really making out what you might define as spot cracks, I don't know. But I don't want any more of it, do you hear?
Just as you please, Mr. Hoxton.
I... Oh, Lord, where was I?
His face was a ghastly whitish color, and his eyes had become glassy.
Sounds like me. All right. A single choking cry escaped his lips, comma, and his body crumpled to the floor, full stop. New paragraph. With one swift stride, Pendleton King had reached the fallen man.
Mm-mm. He can't have done that, Mr. Hawkstone.
Who can't have done what?
Pendleton King.
What about him?
Well, on the last page, you had him sitting at the foot of the table. So he can't get there in one stride, unless you want him to sail across the room like a kangaroo.
There are times, Miss Phillips, when I should like to poison you, Curare, and dance on your grave.
I was only trying to help.
All right, change it, change it. Strike it out. With hardly a second's delay, how's that? Comma. Pendleton King had reached the fallen man. Full stop. New paragraph. Quote. I feared it, comma. Close quote. He muttered. Full stop. Quote. Note the rigidity of the muscles. Exclamation point. Note the characteristic odor of you Curare, which...
That won't do, Mr. Hoxton.
Why not?
Curare hasn't got any odor.
Now there, Miss Phillips, you've really gone too far.
But I can't help that. It's true.
If you will permit the small vanity, I am noted for the correctness of my medical knowledge. Who is murdering the Lord Chief Justice, you or I?
You are, but you might murder him properly. Curare hasn't got any odor.
I say it has.
And I say it hasn't.
Listen, Miss Phillips. I propose to settle this rather childish dispute by going next door and asking Dr. Roberts. Will that convince you?
Curare hasn't got any odor. Anyway, the Lord Chief Justice wouldn't be mixed up in any such silliness as this.
Silliness, eh?
Yes, I said silliness. Read your evening paper. The Lord Chief Justice is sentencing some American gangster who got involved in a robbery over here. That's the sort of thing he really does.
You're very fond of these gangster reports, aren't you?
Yes, I am, because they're real.
Real? Ha!
Don't you say ha to me.
But merely remarking, Mr. Richard, with your usual ingenuity, you sidetracked the argument. I am going to see Dr. Roberts. That's not necessary, of course. My own knowledge of poisons is as great as that of any doctor.
Dr. Fa.
And finally, kindly don't say fa to me, either. When I return, Miss Phillips, I hope to find you in a better frame of mind. Please observe that I, at least, have been able to keep my temper. Excuse me.
All right. Go on. See if I care.
Oh, excuse me, but...
Good evening, Mr. Hawkstone.
Good evening, Mrs. Roberts. May I come in?
Of course. Mind the blackout curtains. My, isn't it hot and stuffy tonight?
Rather close, yes. Is the doctor in?
I'm afraid he isn't, Mr. Hawkstone, but I expect him back any minute.
Oh, out on a call?
No, I'm almost certain he isn't, because that's his medicine case and stethoscope there on the table. I think he's just gone up the road to get some tobacco.
Do you mind if I wait?
Not at all. But you will excuse me if I run along. I promised Mrs. Anderson I'd drop in there. It's her neuralgia again, and I'm terribly late already.
Don't let me detain you, Mrs. Roberts. Go right ahead.
I'm afraid you'll have to wait in George's consulting room. I've got most of the house dark, so I could keep the windows open. You know which room it is.
Yes, I could find it blindfolded.
Oh, and I wonder if you take the medicine case and stethoscope and drop them in the consulting room. George is so careless, he lets them lie about anywhere.
Medicine case? Stethoscope, yes. As a matter of fact, I've always wanted to hang one of these things around my neck like this. Look almost like a doctor, don't I? Good night, Mrs. Roberts.
Good night, Mr. Hawkstone. See you later.
So what I write is silliness, eh? And I don't know anything about poisons. And I call her Miss Phillips instead of Patricia. Ah, here we are. Where's that light switch? Good Lord.
Run in, Doc. Close the door.
Who the deuce are you?
You want to keep healthy, Doc, just do what you're told. Come in and close the door.
Is that by any chance a revolver you're pointing at me?
There ain't no cigarette case. I'm warning you.
Well, I'm hanged. I've done it 1,000 times in stories, but I never thought...
Don't drop that junk you're carrying, either. You're going to need it, Doc, when you come along with me.
Come along with you? Where?
Just to see a guy, that's all.
To see a... Oh, wait a minute. You don't think I'm the doctor?
Now, look, Doc. I ain't got any time for gags, see? The boss says to bring you, so I bring you. There'll be a very sick man out there if you don't go.
Yes, there'll be a very dead man out there if I do go. I tell you, old man, you're making a terrible mistake.
Now, look, Doc.
My name is Hawkstone. I live next door. I'm not a medical man, and I never...
Somebody's coming.
Miss Phillips.
Now then, Dr. Hawkstone, just look here in the encyclopedia.
So you ain't the doctor, huh?
That's done. It's
just a real old-fashioned kidder, ain't you? Now you keep quiet, lady. You know it's good for you.
I know you. I've seen your picture. You're a big Louie Miller.
Pretty smart thing you got here,
Doc. Listen, Mr.
Take it easy, Mrs.
Big Louie Miller and Flats Kelly. Flats Kelly is the gang leader. Well, we're supposed to be friends of this gang students on trial in London now. But I hadn't heard they were in England.
No, lady. Neither has anybody else.
No, well, for it.
Who is this dame, Doc? You nice?
No, she's my secretary. She doesn't know anything about this.
She seems to know too much about it, if you ask me. Come on, lady. You go on with us.
Going? Where?
Just for a little ride, lady. Just for a little ride.
Out from the village, in flat and miry swampland, where pools of stagnant water gleam under the moon, stands the old Rutherford House. It is a desolate place, on the track of Field Marshal Goering's bombers when they crossed the coastline. But there are no searchlights here, and no guns. Only the heat on the glimmering marshes, and the decaying, weather-boarded house, as a motor car approaches them.
Drive straight ahead, Doc. I'm out of the back of the house. Remember, I still got this rod against the back of your neck.
As a matter of fact, you are rather enjoying this. All except the murder.
What murder? We ain't gonna bump anybody off.
Maybe not you, old boy, but I am. Just wait till I get at your patient.
I don't see how you can joke about this.
I'm not joking, Miss Phillips. It really won't tell us what's wrong with the patient.
Never you mind the patient, Doc. You just drive around here. Yeah, whoa. So, right here.
So this is the enchanted castle, eh?
Climb out of here. Walk ahead of me over to that house.
Come on, Miss Phillips.
That's right, lady. You too. Come on. Hey, hold on, Doc. Grab a can of this cleaning fluid here. You can help me carry it in.
Cleaning fluid?
Yeah, there are two kinds of it. If I can carry one, then I need my other hand for this rod. Come on. Come on. We got all night. Get it out of the back seat.
Professionally, this is a little out of my line of duty. What do you want with the cleaning fluid?
The boss's suits get all messed up, so I clean them for him. I play nice maid and everything around here. Come on now, straight ahead, stop asking questions.
But you got this place blacked out, Louis. If the police don't get you, the air raid warden will.
Forget it, Doc. We got this place so sealed up, you can hardly breathe inside.
In here?
That's right, lady. Go ahead. I'll close the door.
I can't see, old boy. Which way?
Here. Set that can down and follow me.
You too, lady.
Right here, where the curtain's hanging over the door. Now, I want you to meet the boss. So I open the curtain like this.
Howdy, Doc. Come right in.
Glad to see you. I've been expecting you.
Glad to see you, old man. I imagine you're the celebrated Mr. Kelly.
That's me, Doc. Flats Kelly to you.
Glad to see you taking this nice and friendly. Louis, what's the idea of bringing in the day?
I couldn't help it, boy.
Oh.
She's as nice, see? She was with him. And she knew who I was.
She did, eh?
I don't know anything. All I want to do is to go home.
That's all right, sister. You'll go home all nice and friendly.
As soon as I've had a little talk with the doctor.
A talk about what?
Well, we're not what you might call comfortable here, Doc. But we've got flashlights, canned food, plenty of liquor, portable radio that works on a battery. Now we manage to get along. You know what I mean?
I said to talk about what?
Well, that's it. That's what I'm going to tell you. We pulled a snatch, see?
You pulled a snatch?
They kidnapped somebody.
That's right, sister. You speak English.
May I ask who was snatched?
Well, I'll tell you, Doc, because it'll hand you a big laugh. The guy we snatched was the big shot you call the Lord Chief Justice.
You snatched the Lord Chief Justice?
We sure did, Doc, and his clerk, too. They're in the room right over there.
Such a trap, Louis.
I didn't mean nothing, boys. I was only trying...
Did you hear me say such a trap?
Okay.
But look here, what was the idea behind this snatch?
Well, I'll tell you, Doc.
We got a pal, see?
Well?
Dominic Ferrelli, his name is. He's up on a grand larceny rap, and Ferrelli don't like Limey Jail. He don't like him at all. Besides, the dirty little rat owes me 14G.
So what do we do? Snatch the Lord Chief Justice, apparently, but why?
Because the mouthpiece back home tells me long ago that a man can't be sentenced except for the judge that tried him.
And the Lord Chief Justice is the judge who tried Dominic Ferrelli, is that it?
That's right, Doc. But it ain't the main thing. This Chief Justice is a pretty important guy, see? So what do? We write to the cops and say, now look, we got the old bird in a place where you'll never find him, and if you want to keep things nice and friendly, just spring Dominic Ferrelli.
Bring him?
Turn him loose.
Sure. Bring Ferrelli, and you'll get the old judge back in one piece. If you don't do it, you'll get him back with his head as full of holes as a Swiss cheese. And we're not kidding.
This is horrible. I can't stand it.
Take it easy, sister. Take it easy.
You know, Seth, I admire you tremendously.
You do, Doc. Why?
Because you've invented a crazier idea than I ever did.
Just what do you mean with that crack, Doc?
You don't honestly think the government will make a bargain with you.
I sort of think they will, Doc. I sort of think they will.
But what if they don't?
It'll be just too bad for a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Well, wouldn't I like to give that judge a going over?
Louis got a sort of a grudge against the old guy, Doc.
Well, wouldn't you have?
Louis' temperamental, see? He gets bored easy. So he says to the old guy and his clerk, he says, can you play poker? Just says, sure. So they play poker from 6 p.m. to 5 a.m. And what do you know? If the old judge don't win, all Louis' dough.
They're rung in a call back on me. That's how they done it. They're a couple of crooks.
Are you accusing the Lord Chief Justice of playing poker with Mark Card?
He won my dough, didn't
Shut up, Louis.
Okay, boy.
Not that I blame Louis much. The things I've had to take from that judge. Well, that's where you come in, Doc.
I was just wondering about that. Which of one of them is...
Nobody hurt. Not yet.
Then what the devil do you want with me?
I want them kept quiet so they don't keep trying to escape. We can't get tough with them, not until I get Ferrelli and my 14Gs. I want you to give them a hypodermic or something that'll keep them out cold for 2 days. Can you do that?
Why, yes, I don't know. I suppose I could.
Oh, no, for heaven's sake, be careful.
Now, what do you use to dope them?
Well, under the circumstances and considering all the... factors involved, I think I should use morphine.
Have you got any morphine in that black satchel?
Oh, yes.
Plenty of morphine.
I always go about equipped for these little emergencies.
Well, then open the satchel. Come on, open it.
Well, there you are.
Dozens of little bottles, anyway. Now then, Doc, which one of them bottles is the one that has the morphine in it?
The fact is, Seth...
Come on, which one is it?
Listen, Forrest. Louis, how many times do I have to tell you to shut up?
Yeah, but it's the midnight news. The news on the radio. You said you wanted to hear it. It's after midnight now.
Why didn't you tell me?
It's all right, boss. I switched the radio on.
Well, then keep quiet, all of you.
A couple of seconds now, you're going to hear some mighty sweet news.
I wonder.
So do I.
Quiet.
Lord Chief Justice.
And that's us, Hannah.
The Chief stated Superintendent Hadley of the CID, seemed to entertain a belief that no sentence could be passed on a criminal except by the judge who tried him. Whatever may be the law in certain American states, this is not the case here. Dominic Ferrelli, alias Dominic Stevens, was today sentenced by Mr. Justice Stoneman to 14 years hard labor and this evening entered Dartmoor prison.
Why, that's...
One moment, please.
Oh, you told me...
Take it easy, boy. Take it easy.
Kelly, he's as white as a ghost and his mouth is twisting back as though...
Here is a bulletin just received. Scotland Yard flying squad cars assisted by the constabulary of a county which for obvious reasons cannot be named are closing in on the two kidnappers believed to be men already wanted in the United States for murder.
That's right.
Will anyone who has any further information about these men whose descriptions follow communicate with New Scotland Yard telephone number Whitehall 171.
Wait, I get my hands on it.
That's all right, boys. Everything's all right now. I turn it off.
Come on, turn it off, Louis. I'll fix that thing.
Hey, what are you going to do, boss?
Hey, don't bust the radio.
Oh, you're heading on the bus of the radio, boss. Now we can't get any news.
We've had our news lately. Come on, put that light out. I want to look out the window.
Patricia, you see, I can't call you that.
Why couldn't you have called me that weeks ago?
Oh, well, putting that aside, I thought it was half a joke. But I'm not joking now. I intend to get that rat-faced slap if it's the last thing I ever do.
It probably will be. But how are you going to?
First, Pendleton King, my dear. He's
for really, you sir, 14,000 bucks gone. And the cops are not here while we stand here yapping. You heard what that radio said, Louis.
Yeah, I heard it, all right. Look, boss, we better lamb out of here while
it's... Sure we will, Louis. Before we go, we settle things with the old guy in the yellow roof. can't get away with it, Lewis.
This is England. They'll hang you.
Oh, what? We got a murder rap to face in the state, did we? And I just as soon hang as fry? What about you, Louis?
You said it, boss.
Let me take this rod of mine, stick it against the back of the old guy's neck. And
No. No rods. That's too easy.
Easy? Sure. One slug and it's all over. This guy rates special treatment. And that's where the doctor comes in. You know anything about poisons, Doc?
I know a good deal about poisons. The customers like murder.
What's that?
Oh, nothing. Just a slogan in my profession.
Look, Louis, do you remember the time Johnny Presco was running the old Third Avenue Social Club?
Yeah.
And Mike Delaney talks out of turn? And they feed him some white stuff called strychnine?
Oh, yeah.
And sit around and light cigarettes and watch him die. It took 4 hours, Doc, and you could hear the rats screaming as far as 81st Street.
Now, wait a minute. That's you, Carl.
I can't. We'll see. You got any of that white stuff, Doc?
Well, I...
Come on.
I'm
now,
right.
You've got something
I
in that bag that'll make the old guy squeal now, haven't you?
Why, yes, I suppose
well,
I have,
but... Listen, get this sure. You can do it the hard way, Doc, or you can do it the easy way. Louis gets to work on you. Maybe you'd be smarter to hand the stuff over right now. What do you say?
What? What's the matter, Fat? Troubled by the heat? It is hot in here with all the windows sealed up.
That sounds like planes.
It is planes.
British planes gone over to put the heat on Germany?
Well, such luck, old boy. German planes coming to bomb us. About
a dozen Heinkels flying 20,000 feet up.
Mm-hmm. They're keen here, Miss Phillips. Say, I'd say not over 15. That's the first wave, Seth. There'll be another wave in a minute or two. But you needn't be alarmed. They're going somewhere else. They only...
Louisa, the way I heard you squat from under the table already.
Only a little visiting guard, Flats, and fully a quarter of a mile away.
Well, I'd like to pull that curtain back off the window.
Yeah, but what's it?
See what you can see.
Okay.
Do what I tell you,
right,
Luck.
All right. Hey, check there, thing.
The sky is black as pitch.
Oh, look over there.
Well, what is it?
It's a light, Flats. Funny kind of a white light. Up there over the tree. Not very steady. It starts and then dims. And then it starts and dims.
Only a basket of incendiary bombs, Louis.
Incendiaries, eh?
What is it, Jerry? Have you got an idea?
Louis, this is just what we've been waiting for. Those Scotland Yard cars are going to get held up until we can settle things with those guys in the other room. Come along with me.
Why don't you two lugs get smart?
Jerry.
What's that? You don't want to have your neck cracked on a rope, do you? Or burn in the electric chair back home?
What are you getting at?
Why not take advice from somebody who's been killing people in a professional way for 15 years?
I'm not in the mood for gags, Doc, but keep on talking.
This Lord Chief Justice in his clerk, what does he look like?
Well, the judge is a little guy with a bald head like me. And the other one is a big guy with a punch-drunk tan like Louis. Why?
I thought so. I've seen their photographs. When the next wave of planes comes over, and it will, why shouldn't an incendiary bomb hit this house?
You mean you think I ain't too safe, sir?
Be quiet, Louis. Go ahead, Doc.
In other words, you leave the Lord Chief Justice in his clerk tied up in the other room. Then all you have to do is to set fire to the place. Justice cheated, Mendicant gangsters die and blaze.
Jerry Hawkstone, have you gone crazy?
They may catch you eventually, yes. But it'll give you a few days' start.
Hey, maybe you got something there, Doc.
It's got to look good. This house must go up like a piece of paper in a furnace. Past any possibility of being put out.
Yeah, and that's the catch.
Why so?
This house is in the middle of a swamp, see? It's as damp as your own climate. You couldn't make it burn with a blowtorch.
Oh, yes, you could. Aren't you forgetting the cleaning fluid?
Cleaning fluid?
In that other room, you've got 2 gallons of cleaning fluid. That's benzene, a derivative of petrol. Soak every inch of the floor of that room with it, every inch of it, mind, and the place will go up like tinder.
Well, it's worth a try, Louis. Turn on your flashlight.
Okay, boss.
And, what about you two, Doc? Afterwards?
We're accessories, aren't we? Are we likely to talk?
Better put a couple of slugs in them for us and drop them on the road. What's one or two more bumps in a spot like this?
Maybe you're right at that. Well, anyway, Doc, thanks for a swell idea. You heard what the doctor said, Louis. Get going to that cleaning step.
Both of you had better do it. I'm warning you.
Oh, why?
Hear that? Because there isn't much time. Here they come. You can't have a fire stop after the last wave of planes has gone over.
Well, maybe you got something there, too. But I'll just take a little precaution first.
What are you going to do?
These are handcuffs, sister. Two of the neatest pair of cuffs we ever swiped off a dumb cop. Come on, just lock your arms around the back of the chair, like this. And the doc's arms around the back of his chair, like this. And we'll get going.
Come on, Louis, through the curtain.
Okay, I'm coming, boys. Bye-bye, Mr. Hawkstone, and your lady friend. Be seeing you in the funny papers. Go in the morgue.
It won't be long now. They must have everything in there soaked with that benzene by now. Jerry, I know you can't be completely crazy.
Many thanks, my dear, for the qualification. You're right. They have soaked the place with benzene. And if they strike a match before...
I know you've got some kind of a scheme, but do you think it'll work?
I don't know, my dear. I thought of it once for a story.
Oh, you and your story.
Me and my stories, as Louis will put it, may save our hides yet.
But suppose it doesn't work.
Then we're done for.
What are you trying to do?
There's a place you missed, boy.
Yeah, I got
it. Listen. It's not working. But it's got to work.
What's got to work?
For all I know, 5 minutes. Must be at least that. They've been pouring out that benzene an inch at a time all over the...
What's the matter?
Listen.
What's the matter, you big lad? Something's got me, boy.
It's working, Patricia. I think our friends are lit.
No, they're not. Schlaf is coming back.
What? Look at you. What's the matter with Louie? What's the matter with me?
You've lost the game, Slat. You're finished.
Oh, I'm finished, Alan.
It's the benzene fumes, old man. To pour out all cleaning fluid in an airtight room like that one is practically certain death. You know, Slat, you ought to learn more about crime. No, you won't, Slat. You can't reach your gun. The fumes have got you. You can't move your arms or legs. Your eyesight's going. In 1 second more, you'll be... Got him. Dead to the world.
You mean...
It worked, Patricia. It's practical. It worked.
Are you trying to tell me that you killed those two men?
Not necessarily. Listen.
That sounds like cars.
Oh, the police cars. We're just about to be sensationally rescued, just like fiction.
Jerry.
Come on in and get us, you lug.
Don't talk like Louis, or we'll get a bullet through the head yet.
Yeah, that is a thought.
We're prisoners. We're victims. This way, please. Mr. Sergeant, and I was never so glad to see a uniform in my life.
Hey, now. What's going on in this place? Louis Miller knocked out in that room? And blimey, if it's not Slats Kelly knocked out in this room.
Just a couple of mugs I polished off, Sergeant, all in the day's work.
You mean they did?
They'll be all right if you drag them out in the open air.
Oh, you, I recognize you. You're the writer who was kidnapped tonight.
Yes, and you will find the other snatches in that room. But first of all, have you got a key that'll unlock regulation police handcuffs?
I certainly have, sir, and I'll get you loose in a jiffy.
Never mind me, Sergeant. Never mind my handcuffs. Get this lady free. She's the one I'm concerned about.
You know, that's awfully kind of you. It's something practically chivalrous.
Chivalry, my eye.
There you are, young lady.
Have you got your notebook and pencil in that handbag?
You don't want me to take dictation now.
A true artist, madam, takes no account of time or place. Are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Hawkstone.
Well, you admit now that my plot is practical.
Yes, Mr. Hawkstone.
Now then, the income tax murder by Gerald Hawkstone, chapter one.
But Mr. Hawkstone...
Just as Big Ben was striking midnight, a hooded face looked into the window of the luxurious study occupied by the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Full stop. The hooded figure chuckled as it softly lowered inside the window a large tin of cleaning fluid. New paragraph. The Chancellor himself was hard at work devising a new scale of income tax.
But Mr. Hawkstone, that's a completely different story. I thought you were going to murder the Lord Chief Justice.
And to any professional taste, how can I murder the Lord Chief Justice? I just saved his life.
So ends The Customer's Light Murder, starring Roland Young with Peggy Conklin. Tonight's tale of suspense. This is your narrator, the man in black, who conveys to you Columbia's invitation to spend this half hour in suspense with us again next Tuesday, same time, when our story will be The Dead Sleep Lightly. William Spear, the producer, John Deets, the director, Bernard Herrmann, the composer-conductor, and John Dixon Carr, the author, elaborated on tonight's suspense.
Do you know how old the school building in your community is? If it's over 25 years old, the chances are that it's woefully inadequate. Join with the groups in your community working for better school conditions. Remember, better schools build a stronger America.
Okay, we're moving on into The Price of Fear now, which I suppose will always be more associated with Vincent Price, the host of the series, than its British provenance, with the BBC's, which first broadcast during the spring of 1973, an initial order of 5 episodes. Then, during the same year of 1973, the BBC ordered another 5, which it combined with the previous 5 and aired on both Tuesdays and Saturdays from September the 1st of 1973 to November the 6th. In 1974, BBC Radio 4 ordered another 6 installments of the episode, which it aired from April the 6th of 1974 through May the 11th. Then, 8 years passed before Radio 4 ordered another 6 installments in 1982, which then aired between May the 30th and July the 4th of that year. If you add these up, it makes 22 episodes, and I don't suppose they're all splendid. But everyone I've played so far, I think, is very good, including tonight's episode, An Eye for an Eye, from the 1974 series.
The Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
Hello. I know there are those amongst you who will consider the old adage, every picture tells a story, as debatable as it is familiar. As a lifelong art collector and enthusiast myself, I have often speculated that the story surrounding a picture, the human drama, can prove infinitely more fascinating than any story in paint. Trapped within the confines of a frame, and the tale I'm about to tell you, which I've called An Eye for an Eye, will, I'm sure, convince you of the truth of this. Recently, I went to an important sale of Impressionist paintings. The auction room just off London's fashionable St. James was packed to capacity with art speculators from the four corners of the globe.
Lot 23, Auguste Renoir, anemones, oil on canvas 38 inches by 14, an opening bid of 25,000, and 5, 30, 35, bidding at 35 against you, sir, 40, 45, thank you, now standing at 45.
Renoir, Monet, Manet, Degas, each in their turn glowed briefly down at us from the auctioneer's easel, to be knocked down with almost indecent haste and returned backstage for crating and shipping.
Lot 97, Camille.
The auctioneer's voice was tiring now. The serious business of the day was over.
Lot 98, Study of a Girl. Attributed to Pissarro, unsigned, unauthenticated. Oil on canvas, 20 inches by 12, from the estate of the Count Luigi della Santa. Opening bid invited, I think, ladies and gentlemen.
Study of a Girl. And there she was, smiling into the gloom of that near-deserted auction room. My old friend, Luigi della Santa, notorious acquisitor of yachts and palazzos and paintings and celebrities. Now here, this, his last prized acquisition, Study of a Girl. as I consulted the catalogue and smiled ruefully, that even in death, Luigi steadfastly insisted on his beloved title of Count. It seemed ironically appropriate that the pedigree of his beloved painting should now turn out to be as unauthenticated as his own. But how long ago it all seemed. How long? Midsummer. I'd just completed a long stint of filming in and around Naples. After the sweltering heat of those studio arcs, Luigi's invitation to spend a few days with him on his yacht, anchored off of Sorrento, would have been eagerly accepted in any event, but I remembered as the launch ferried me across the merest smoothness of that beautiful bay that it was the prospect of at last viewing Luigi's recently acquired Pissarro that made the invitation totally irresistible.
Well, Cenzo, you like it? Well?
Well, it's beautiful, quite beautiful.
Of course. You see, Contessa, didn't I tell you that my very good and wise friend would come and that he would like it, didn't I?
Yes, Luigi, you did.
And now, Vincenzo, you must tell me how much you like it. $5,000 worth? $10,000?
Luigi, she's exquisite.
Exquisite? Oh, she's perfection. She is the perfection of perfection. She is the perfection of perfection.
You're spilling your wine, Carol.
And yet, would you believe it, when I tell you, my friend, there are still those dilettantes, those ingrates, those whoremongers who have the gall to insult the intelligence by saying that it cannot be the work of the master.
Oh, but Luigi, the master did not think fit to sign it.
What need for him to sign it when every line makes a signature? I tell you, this is not a painting. It is an experience. She's alive, vibrant.
Oh, such passionate enthusiasm, Luigi. I shall begin to suspect I have acquired a rival. Vincenzo, if you will permit. It is not the wine of my country, but then it is not the wine of my choosing. Mm-hmm. The Count prefers to import. So instead of buona fortuna, permit me to wish you bonne chance.
Bonne chance. As she proposed the toast, the charms of Luigi's Contessa di Terra made those of the artist model obvious, commonplace. And it was almost as though the Contessa were reading my thoughts.
But I feel sure you will forgive dear Luigi's schoolboy enthusiasm for this new acquisition, Vincenzo. As a lifelong friend, you will doubtless have witnessed many such enthusiasms.
Well, it isn't difficult to forgive. I so wholeheartedly share.
Ah, bravo, my friend.
Perhaps. But between you and Luigi, the appreciation has always been different, I think.
Oh? How different?
Be warned, Vincenzo. It is not wise to encourage her.
Because watching you see the painting for the very first time, there was peace. It was not hard to tell that for you, the appreciation was for the talent it contained, for the genius. You understood what had been intended and what had been achieved.
And for me? Is it not the same for me?
Prego, Luigi, permit me to finish. You see, Vincenzo, before Luigi permits me the time to make a point, he is so perfectly demonstrating it. It is not what the painting does inside of him that makes him so determined to possess it. It is simply because there are others who might wish to possess it even more than he does. The price is all that is important for him. He asks how much you think it is worth. $5,000? $10,000? And when you refuse to give him the answer...
Am unable to.
See how prettily he sulks. Oh, it's not his fault, you understand. It does not make me love him less, but everything in this so beautiful life is reduced to the level of price, status, possession. Everything which is bad enough, but everyone worse. Oh. Much worse. But possession, life, cannot always be that simple. People, things, cannot always be caught in the net of our understanding. Just as it is not always possible to divorce the manner of our deaths from the manner of our lives.
Ah, tante dante. Much talk makes for much hunger.
scusa, Count. La colazione è servito.
Sì, Carlos, sì. Come, my friends, we are to take luncheon on the deck. Besides, after so much play-acting in the dark Vicenzo, it is now necessary we turn the color to your cheeks.
Well, there's nothing I'd like better.
Also, and most important, Luigi has yet another treat in store for you.
Another?
Si. To mark the private viewing of his so beautiful painting, the great Luigi, master chef of all the Italias, has himself created a unique gastronomic masterpiece. A meal worthy of a gourmet of such international repute as you.
Oh, my dear Luigi, such flattery. At this rate, the color will be returned to my cheeks much sooner than you anticipate.
We shall see, Vincenzo. We shall see.
Contessa?
We shall see.
Our lunch party looked like being a jolly affair, to begin with, anyway. The wine and the sun went straight to our heads, and the Contessa's affectionate baiting of Luigi continued good-humoredly as the first course was served. The question of Luigi's title provided her readiest target of attack. As to his true origins, well, there were many who insisted that his father could still be found running a small trattoria in that straggling, impoverished town we now viewed across the bay.
So why doesn't he admit it? Be proud to admit it. You see, it is always so. What he refuses to accept, he laughs away. Is that not so, Vicenzo?
I think I'll just concentrate on this excellent wine.
Oh, but you disappoint me. What? You tell me that you, too, are afraid to burst this ridiculous balloon.
Perhaps because Vicenzo has the good sense to realize it is not a balloon. And that it certainly is not ridiculous. It is...
What is it, Bambino? What is it?
It is an insult. It is a double insult of my lineage and breeding.
Oh, I'm sorry, Luigi.
Oh, so don't be my friend. It's good to laugh at such archaic distinctions.
Vincenzo has seen the papers. Is that not true?
I have seen papers.
Papers are for the forging. So, has Vincenzo seen my papers? Of course he has not. And why has he not? Because he doesn't need to. He has only to use his eyes to realize that I am of the line, just as you are, of the gutter.
Then why does the Contessa dishonor her line by sitting at my table?
Oh, because even a penniless Contessa has to eat somewhere. And like his cook of a father and his cook of a grandfather before him, Count Luigi still makes the best fish soup in the whole of Italy. True, Carlo?
True, my father and his father before him made the best soup in...
Caught, Carlo.
The Contessa's high praise for Luigi's culinary skills were justified, certainly, whether inherited or not. After a lifetime of experience, I've come to the conclusion that there are only really two kinds of master chef. Those who have spent long years perfecting their skills, and those who have added to this a simple flair, an ability to transform the simplest meal into something near approaching a work of art.
Well, now, my good friends, your attention, your undivided attention, if you please. It is with the greatest pride and pleasure Luigi himself presents to you his own original creation.
Oh!
Specialité of the house. Vincenzo.
Luigi waited. As I peered into the deep serving tureen he set in front of me, I remember thinking that after the great build-up he'd given it, his specialty of the house turned out to be something of an anti-climax. The ingredients were certainly commonplace enough, served on a bed of rice, a veritable hotchpotch of, well, of all the kinds of fish native to the locality, something I'd frequently enjoyed with a bottle of ordinary vino at any harborside trattoria.
So, you like it? But now, why don't you look even closer, my friend?
He was waiting again. So, simply to oblige him, I did look closer. And then I saw it. A large octopus sat squarely upon its bed of lobster pieces and king-sized prawns. To my best recollection, I'd never seen one cooked whole before. So perhaps this was the special touch my Italian friend had in mind. And then it happened. The creature's great saucer eyes opened and gazed balefully into mine. My God, it was alive.
Now he sees. So, how do you like my little beauty?
I'm not sure.
But I have created a new delicacy.
A live delicacy?
Alive, Vincenzo.
Between us, we will set a new gastronomic trend, you see. Oh, purists like the Contessa may at first condemn it. A return to marine cannibalism, perhaps, eh? But I tell you, Vincenzo, and you will agree for yourself, that in the gastronomic stakes, a live lobster boat screaming to the boil will prove strictly for the peasant. Now, please. Well, taste it.
I'm sorry. At first I just thought it was some kind of a joke.
A joke?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm still not sure if you... But it isn't, is it?
No.
I'm sorry, Luigi.
You object?
Well, simply, let's say, decline.
But why...
I can't explain.
Try. For Luigi's sake, why don't you try?
Well, even for Luigi's sake... Well, I'm just not sure I can. It's something to do with the very aliveness of the thing, of course, but more than that, it's the eyes. A sort of watchfulness in the eyes.
You disappoint me, my friend. You know that? You disappoint me.
I'm sorry.
You object. But you cannot even begin to explain why you object.
Luigi, please. Vincenzo is your guest.
For which I'm sorry. Because not only does he show a singular lack of adventure, but because he stupidly finds the dish somehow objectionable on humanitarian grounds. True or not
true?
But why? The oysters you love, are they not live? A well-known scientific fact. All sea creatures are impervious to pain. Any 10-year-old angler will tell you, my friend, they have no brain, no mind, no nervous system, let alone the so-called finer feelings which you and the Contessa would seem to attribute to them. Apart from which, the pathetic specimen you see before you is itself possessed of those same cannibal instincts which you now accuse me of possessing.
I accuse you of nothing, Luigi.
Hourly sucking into the disgusting chasm of its stomach a million tiny sea creatures. To first digest, and then spew out the remains which are neither palatable or necessary to its uniquely selfish existence.
Except that you have overlooked one thing, Luigi.
Huh?
We have no way of knowing. In spite of the sworn word of any 10-year-old angler, we have no way of really knowing whether the creature we see squirming in front of us is capable of feeling or not.
Knowing, my dear Contessa, what is there to know?
Everything. Anything. Simply because, perhaps, it chooses to reveal nothing. We shall never know. Not unless it were possible for one of us to take its place at this very moment, to be on the receiving end.
Permit me to produce the evidence.
With a single deft circular movement of his knife, Luigi removed one of those enormous eyes. The creature attempted vaguely to scale the deep sides of the dish, but at last, realizing there could be no escape, floundered back, stonily regarding Luigi with its one remaining eye. The mucus from its socket mingled now with the rich Madeira of the sauce that had replaced its natural element. Luigi regarded it dispassionately, then flicked the eye on the heavy silver of his embossed plate. That evening, over after-dinner brandies, my squeamishness turned to embarrassment. An apology seemed in order, and I was happy to provide it.
But, my dear Vincenzo, there is nothing to be forgiven. Unless it is the weather. More brandy.
Oh, thank you.
I had planned on taking the launch to show you a few of the night spots across the bay, but I'm afraid until the storm decides to blow itself out...
Think no more of it. I'm really perfectly happy.
Which is a good deal more than can be said for the Contessa, I think. Isn't that so, Caro?
Oh, if you say so, Luigi, then I suppose it must be.
But you've hardly said a word since lunch.
Haven't I?
You know you haven't.
Oh, then I can only blame the storm. Unless it is that it's late and I'm tired. I really would like to retire for the night.
Oh, but of course.
So soon, Contessa. But the night is young.
No, dear Luigi. The night is never young. It is the same age at its birth as at its death. It is we who must inhabit the bright lights of day. We grow old. As old as we are allowed to grow. Good night.
Good night, Countess.
A cigar, perhaps.
I'm sorry, Luigi. I wasn't...
Now you're doing it again, my friend. Apologizing for one thing and overreacting for another.
Am I?
Yes, you're overreacting to my Contessa. But then you have been all day.
Well, then I certainly didn't intend to.
But found it impossible not to.
Well, it is late, Luigi.
You see, my friend, the effect she has on us is infectious.
Oh, please. I only meant it's been rather a long day. But if you'd rather...
No, I insist. Whatever our mysterious lady claims to the contrary, tomorrow is another day. We shall welcome it together.
Well, good night, Luigi. By the way, it's macabre of me, I know... But what did happen?
You want to know what happened to our one-eyed sea monster?
Yes.
Thrown overboard with the rest of the garbage? Oh, not out of any finer sense of returning it to its own. I do assure you, its remains will attract the other sea creatures. The cycle of cannibalism perpetuates itself. Besides, it makes for excellent fishing. If you promise to get up before noon, I'll get one of the crew to fix us up with a couple of lines.
Good night. I lay in my cabin listening to the storm. It was strange how deeply Luigi's mood of the evening had disturbed me. The extrovert, arrogant Luigi... And it had been a long day, so sleep now, gently, gratefully, into sleep. Sleep. Sleep.
Isabella? Isabella, mon amore. Is that you?
Isabella, don't leave me.
No, please don't, Isabella.
Oh, my God. No. No. Oh.
It was the steward, Carlos, who found him. But having seen what he had seen, he would not again venture into the cabin. straddled grotesquely across the bed in a splatter of torn flesh and blood was the thing that had been Luigi. There were the marks of giant tentacles about the doll's snapped head. The tongue rolled gigantic from between those swollen purple lips. But overall, there was the unmistakable evidence that the whole head had been somehow inexplicably pulped outwards, as though it had first been sucked in under some enormous, unnatural pressure, fed upon, and the remains spewed out again onto the fine linen of those monogrammed pillows. But not all spewed back. Not all totally discarded. For when I could bring myself to look at the thing again, there was no mistaking the fact. Only one of Luigi's eyes stared back at me. The other's socket lay seeping, empty. The Contessa was standing at my side.
How do we know they have no feeling? How do we know they are not capable of understanding and of revolt? And if revolt, why not revenge? A revenge to be fearfully enacted by others of their own kind. Larger, stronger, more terrifying than anything we dare imagine. There is no evidence such monsters do exist. But is there any proof that they do not?
I looked away from that single cyclops eye, and leading from what remained a trail of slime, much like the slime of some enormous slug, I followed its course. It climbed the French brocade wallpaper, shattered the high chromium finish of the porthole, crossed the deep teak polish of the deck beyond, and from thence it slimed down the hull. The spume of it still floated out there, oil-like, on the calm waters of that beautiful Italian bay. Then it descended eternally into the dark depths that lay beneath.
That was Vincent Price bringing you The Price of Fear, with Roger Snowden, Anne Jemison, and Christopher Bidmead. An Eye for an Eye was first recounted and dramatized by William Ingram and produced by John Dias.
This interesting bit of information is from March 8th, 1939, and probably at that point, something everybody in Britain needed to know.
Now, what we're going on with this morning is the use of the respirator in a gas attack. Now, the first thing you would do is you'd hold your breath. The reason being, if you didn't hold your breath, you'd breathe in the poison gas and you'd be gassed. So that's the reason why you hold your breath.
Two blades are better than one blade. I get the big shear back in debt.
Two blades are better than one blade. And the good news razor from Gillette.
The good news disposable razor with two blades is better than any single blade disposable. With good news, the first blade grabs the whisker and shaves it. Then the second blade can shave it again before it snaps back for a closer shave.
Two blades are better than one blade. That's the good news razor from Gillette. The good news razor from Gillette.
The next program is another one of those radio programs that is really a mystery unto itself. This one is really more of a mystery than most. All I have to go on is the rumor that this show, The First Atomic Sub, originally aired on March the 25th of 1952. The only support I have for this claim is found in the MP3 tag for the file. I guess this is true, but I wouldn't swear to it. Now, in the course of the program, at the beginning, the announcer does give the name of this series as Action 80. I spent a couple of hours Googling my big fat fingers off, and I could find no reference to any old-time radio program called Action 80. None at all. Well, other than this program. So, the entire thing does leave me puzzled. Then again, maybe it was just an unsold pilot. A pilot is made, it doesn't get picked up, and the transcription just gets put away, goes into the closet, into the attic. And then, years later, it shows up again. But now, it's just a ghost, a phantom, a mirage, on wire, or maybe acetate. I wish I knew. So, if any of you out there, any of the couple of hundred of you, happen to know anything about this, please drop me a line. I'm really flummoxed about it. If you listen now, you're going to hear the only evidence that I can find that this show ever existed. Oh, by the way, this program is not as far-seeing as some might think. Most people know that the USS Nautilus was the first atomic submarine, and may remember that it was launched in June of 1954. It was, however, authorized in 1951, so atomic submarines were all in the papers. There may be a point of mild interest here. The atomic submarine, the USS Nautilus, was not the first ship to be called the USS Nautilus, commissioned in the U.S. Navy. The very first was a 12-gun schooner in 1799. There was also another submarine commissioned in 1930 and decommissioned in 1945. There's a lot more, really, on the ships called the Nautilus that I'm not going to go into here.
The broadcast you are about to hear is scientific fiction. Action 80. Attention, SENCLAN 1, Headquarters, Defense Command, Washington. Commander Mark T. Richards, USN, reporting. Addressee, Action 80. Subject, Project Sailfish, Code 7, Classification, Top Secret. Following is brought to your immediate attention. This is urgent. Repeat, this is urgent.
This is Dan Coverley. Stay tuned now as we take you to a naval base somewhere in the United States for a report on the first atomic submarine. Naval Commander Mark T. Richards, reporting.
Pursuant to Huber's orders dated 1 April 1952, I was detached from temporary duty with Naval Defense Command, Washington, and reported to Andrews Field for immediate transportation to New Haven, Connecticut. From there, I was directed to proceed without delay to Naval Base Charlie, where I was to report to Admiral R.L. Carruthers, commanding. In accordance with the above, I was assigned transportation aboard military air transport plane C-868, Andrews Field. At 1300 hours on April 1952, said aircraft departed Andrews Field. After a routine flight, the transport landed at New Haven, Connecticut, time 1642. I reported to the transportation officer and received the driver and the jeep. At 1815, I arrived and reported with orders to the office of Admiral Carruthers.
Richards?
Yes, sir. Putting for duty, sir.
Please sit down.
Thank you, sir.
Cigar?
No, thank you, Admiral.
Imported Havana. Nice aluminum, thing.
Yes, sir. Very nice, sir.
Commander Richards, what do you know about Project Sailfish?
Atomic submarine, sir. Authorized by the Secretary of Defense. Begun May 1949. Designated experimental vessel X-915. Cost about $50 million.
What about the timetable?
And I believe the first atomic sub is scheduled for test runs next year.
I see you've been reading the newspapers.
And the file in the bureau, sir.
Suppose I told you both new ships and the daily papers are wrong. Since this base was activated, Commander, world conditions have changed. The Navy is no longer satisfied with the 8-hour day, the 40-hour week. For this reason, we have been on a round-the-clock basis for almost 6 months. Project Sailfish is 1 year ahead of schedule. Yes, it deserves a whistle. If we could publicly display our accomplishments, in fact, as we can't.
Not even to the Bureau of Ships?
Not even to Congress.
I'm beginning to understand why my orders were classified top secret.
Commander, there are 307 men working on this base. Every single one of these men has been given the most thorough loyalty check possible. Every single one of them has been working and living behind barbed wire for the past 6 months.
But you suspect a leak, sir?
We're not sure. 2 days ago, a convoy arrived at the base. 8 trucks. In one of those trucks was the Steinberg periscope.
I've heard of it, sir.
But not more than a handful have. Yet when the periscope was being installed yesterday aboard the X-915, it fell to the deck, made completely inoperative.
Inoperative? But how in the world...
The cable on the crane lifting into place snapped. Steel cable.
Had it been cut, sir?
It had not. In fact, the lab technicians assured me it simply broke under the strain.
Well, if the lab...
Just a moment. That cable was designed to support 100 tons. The Steinberg periscope weighs less than 20.
Well, yet the cable broke from strain, sir.
All right, Commander. There are two possibilities. One, that the cable was faulty to begin with. The manufacturer's mistake. I'm having Washington check that for me now. Second, that someone on this base somehow... weaken that cable.
Sabotage.
Exactly. Commander, only one thing matters to me right now, that the X-915 completes her first trial runs. They must proceed according to plan, without interruption. That's why I filed my report to Action 80.
Yes, sir. I'll help in any way I can, sir. When do you plan to test the sub? Sometime this month?
Not this month, Commander. Tomorrow.
$2,100, Tuesday, 1 April. After leaving Admiral Carruthers' office, I checked into the BQ. I had dinner at the officer's mess and then looked up Lieutenant Commander Stanley London, Chief Engineering Officer on the base. Admiral Carruthers had suggested I talk to him. His quarters, I was told London was at the docks, working. Naval Base Charlie was surrounded by barbed wire, yet within the base itself was still a smaller area surrounded by more barbed wire, patrolled by armed sailors every 10 yards. I found the inner gate and presented the special yellow pass handed to me by the Admiral. Even with the high priority yellow, I was given the same checkout received by any other visitor to this inner barbed wire area. For here it was, behind the wire, that the United States ship X-915 was moored. The first atomic submarine. Floodlights covered the area. Brought a glaring whiteness over the faces of the men working. But that wasn't what caught my eye. It was the thing that lay alongside the dock. The iron and steel monster that nestled against the pier like a giant pig. And the men swarming over her decks were like her brood come to eat. Here she was, black, hideous, beautiful. The X-915. 5,000 tons, $50 million. The Navy's first line of defense in any future war. The atomic age. Gone down to the sea in ships. I found Lieutenant Commander Stanley London standing just outside a 6x6 wooden shack near the docks. We shook hands. He invited me inside.
Admiral Carruthers phoned you were coming down, Commander.
What's the story, London, about the Steinberg periscope?
What's the story? I wish you could tell me.
Well, how do you feel about it, personally?
Me?
Yes, you, not official Navy. Sabotage? I see.
Don't ask me why I feel that way or what tells me something has gone wrong around here. But something has.
More than just the periscope?
Oh, a lot more. Something else has happened, Commander, to the men, the crew, the officers.
Is it the speed-up?
Well, it could be. 24-hour days, 7-day weeks. Even with 3 shifts, you get the feeling of rush, of hurry. Get it done right now. Get it done yesterday.
Your crane operator, you think he had something to do with it?
Thompson, no. Well, then I could say that about almost every man on the base. They were hand-picked, Commander. Not your stray workman with know-how, but the best. Nobody applied for a job here, not even me. We were all chosen.
And the loss of your periscope doesn't postpone your trial run, say, tomorrow?
Oh, no. Washington didn't take chances with anything on Project Sailfish. Not one, but 2 Steinberg periscopes were made. The second was installed less than an hour ago.
Action 80.
I beg your pardon, Commander?
Basic principle of Action 80, Lyndon. Don't be certain, be twice certain.
Commander, just who is Action 80? I've noticed every order out of this base lists them as an addressee.
Action 80 was born out of the unification program, Lyndon. In charge of all experimental development. Navy, Marine, Air Force, Army, even some civilian experiments. Wherever there's a major project developing, you'll find Action 80 behind it.
Kind of a board of directors overseeing tomorrow?
Yes, except that tomorrow is usually here today.
Yeah.
You remember the B-29, Lyndon? Action 80 was the force behind it. The same was true with radar, jet aircraft, atomic energy. Not so futuristic at that, huh, Lyndon?
And an Action 80 is simply the code designation.
Right. What's your ETD, Fiddler, Lyndon?
Estimated time of departure, 700. 0700, that is.
Good.
Well, Commander, are you...
When the X-915 makes her first trial run at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, Lyndon, I'm going to be aboard. Good night. Zero 0650 hours. Wednesday, 2 April 1952. Captain Z.L. Unger, USN commanding officer, set special sea detail aboard the USS X-915. At 0700, the X-915 was underway. Lieutenant Commander Lyndon and myself stood on the bridge beside Captain Unger. And as the veteran captain gave his orders to the engine room, you'd see the veins in his neck pulsating. The first atomic sub was underway. 0830. The X-915 was in the open sea. Lyndon and I were below decks.
Engines sound good.
Yes. What's our speed, Lyndon?
30 knots. Traveling at 2/3.
Cruise at 50?
Well, that's what the book says. 50 knots.
45 knots submerged.
Ah, been reading the same book, Commander.
Today's test is speed and maneuverability. Test two. Right?
Right. Tomorrow we go for depth.
If we make it today. 1000 hours. Captain Unger gave the command to stand at speed. The X-915 responded softly and efficiently and made 50 knots. 1100 hours. Captain Unger gave the command to flank speed. And we made good 60 knots. Nothing in the United States Navy could catch her. 1200 hours. Speed set at standard. And now the technicians took over, an even dozen swarming over everything mechanical and electronic, giving the X-915 microscopic scrutiny, checking against charts, checking against gauges, checking against sabotage. At 1700 hours, the exercises were secured. At 1730, the X-915 tied up alongside the dock at Naval Base Charlie. The pig boat of tomorrow was everything the Navy had hoped for. And then some. The pig boat of tomorrow was here to stay. Lyndon and I went to the BOQ, changed clothes, and joined Admiral Carruthers for dinner in his office. Lyndon reported, and I listened. If there was sabotage aboard the atomic sub, it had kept itself well hidden. Everybody was pleased. I decided to continue my investigations on shore the next day. Instead of joining Test Run Baker at 0700, Lyndon and I bid the Admiral goodnight and headed for our quarters. 0700, Thursday, 3 April, 1952. The USS X-915 underway for depth test. 0800. I began an investigation of the dock area. 0930. I was summoned to the office of Admiral Carruthers. The messenger said it was urgent.
Never mind that. Put me through to Washington at once. That's right. At once. Come in, Commander Richards. Hello.
Washington.
Get me the Secretary of Defense.
I don't care where he is now. Get him.
All right. Call me back right away. Commander.
Yes, sir.
There are some charts on that table over there. Get them. I want them on my desk.
Yes, sir.
What? He's in a meeting. What the dickens do I care if he's in a meeting? No, I don't care if he's with the president. Get him. Right.
Here are your charts, sir.
Good. You know the test area for today's trials, Richard. Circle them.
Yes, sir. I believe this covers Area Stork, Admiral.
Sorry to keep you in suspense this week, Commander, but I haven't had time to explain. What? You've got him. Oh, good. Hello. Hello? Yes, this is Carruthers. Yes, sir. Yes, that's right. No, nothing's changed. No, sir. I want authority to put Plan Zebra in effect at once. Yes, at once. Good. Thank you. Yes, right away. All right, Commander Richards, this is it. The X-915 began depth maneuvers at 0800. It would remain at various depths until 0900. It is now 940. The X-915 has not surfaced.
But what about radio contacts, sir?
Silence. They have not answered a radio message since 845.
Then they're in trouble.
No, Commander, I do not think the atomic sub is in trouble.
But surely if they haven't answered radio calls...
That sub was equipped with any number of special emergency devices, including an automatic marker which would immediately rise to the surface should any trouble develop with the engine.
No markers ever did, sir?
Furthermore, if she were on the bottom, her captain had only to press a key to discharge a large buoy.
Then if she isn't in trouble, there's
only one conclusion. The X-915 is deliberately remaining silent and is proceeding under her own orders to some unknown destination.
And her destroyer escorts have lost contact with her?
The accompanying destroyers report the sub disappeared off their sonar screen at full submerged speed, 45 knots. No destroyer in our fleet could catch her, even if we knew where she was heading. Commander Richards, there is only one possible conclusion. The X-915 has fallen into enemy hands.
1000 hours, 3 April 1952. Admiral Carruthers' office. Amidst the deluge of telephone calls, teletypes, and clattering decoding machines, the Admiral explains Plan Zebra.
15 plans were evolved, covering each phase of the trial runs of Project Sailfish. Each plan covered a particular contingency. Of all 15, Plan Zebra was to be used only in the case of extreme emergency.
Yes, sir.
In brief, Plan Zebra covered the possibility of capture of the X-915 by alien forces. You see, Commander Richards, even though such an occurrence as this was unlikely in the extreme, every possible mishap in this operation had to be provided for.
And the Secretary gave you permission to put this plan into effect, sir?
Roger. Within half an hour, a task force will steam out of 3 separate bases on the Atlantic coast. They will rendezvous at this point. Here, on the chart.
That's about 100 miles southeast of this base.
Right. When the task force is rendezvoused, they will then begin Search Able, which is the second step in Plan Zebra.
To find the X-915.
Not to find the X-915, Commander Richards. To sink her.
Hours. Still no word from the X-915. Destroyers escorting the atomic sub on a second trial run had watched her dive and had never regained either visual, radar, or sonar contact. The fathometers aboard the destroyers supported the Admiral's theory that the X-915 was not on bottom. Again, only one conclusion remained. The atomic sub was proceeding to destination unknown under her own orders. Either the crew was composed entirely of traitors, which was unlikely in view of the exhaustive loyalty checks made on them, or some small portion of that crew, perhaps but a handful of men, had succeeded in taking over command of the vessel. With the sub maintaining complete radio silence, this latter point could only be guessed. 1130 hours. Admiral Carruthers established radio contact with the task force, which had now begun to rendezvous at Point Stork. The task force commander, Captain Stevens, was designated by the code name Red Dog 1 for radio communications. Admiral Carruthers was using Pierpoint 5.
This is Red Dog 1. This is Red Dog 1. Hello, Pierpoint 5. Hello, Pierpoint 5. This is Red Dog 1. How do you read me? Over.
Hello, Red Dog 1. This is Pierpoint 5. I read you 5 by 5.
Pierpoint 5. This is Red Dog 1. Group has met at Point Stork. Over.
Red Dog 1 from Pierpoint 5. Execute search plan Able. Good luck. Over.
Pierpoint 5. Thank you. Over.
Captain Stevens is a good man, Commander. If anyone can catch them, he can.
The sub has a pretty fair lead, Admiral. We haven't got anything in the fleet that can make good 45 knots submerged.
I don't know who's commanding the X-915 right now, Richards. But he's smart. He isn't traveling submerged.
I don't understand your point, sir. What about our air search? They'd spot him in a minute if he surfaced.
The sub is equipped with Mark 10 radar. That means they can pick up a plane or an Air Force group 100 miles away. By traveling on the surface, he can make good 60 knots. He'll have plenty of time to dive before being spotted by the Air Force.
And at 60 knots, we haven't the slightest chance of...
I'm afraid you're right, Commander. Yes? Oh, yes, just a minute.
Commander, it's for you. You take it in the other office, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Richard speaking.
Commander Richard, sir.
Yes, who is it?
Sir, this is the sentry down the torpedo shack.
Yes, go on.
Well, sir, you remember when you were down here this morning about 9 o'clock? You told us to leave, you know, if anything funny happened.
All right, sentry, what have you found?
Well, sir, Commander, that's just it. We didn't find nothing. You see, one of them torpedo cases came open just a little while ago, and we seen they were empty. Somebody taken them atomic warheads out of them during the night.
All right, get 10 men. No, make it 20. Search the entire storeroom, search the base. Check back with me in 30 minutes.
No, we haven't got time for that now. And see why that second fighter group hasn't contacted our task force yet. Right. Oh, you, Commander. You've got to try, even when you know you can't possibly win.
Admiral, I've got an idea.
Idea? I hope it contains a miracle.
It contains a 1,000-to-1 shot.
I'd say that's about 1,000,000-to-1 better than our chances right now. What is your idea, Commander?
I received a phone call just now. That phone call was from the sentry down at the torpedo shack. Admiral, he told me he found the atomic warhead crates empty.
Empty?
They're conducting a thorough search, but I don't imagine they'll find them.
Commander Richard, do you realize the gravity of your remarks? Those crates were marked torpedoes, but you know as well as I do what they actually contained.
Yes, sir. They contained atomic warheads for the rockets aboard the X-915. They were scheduled for use on the final trial run.
Equipped with those warheads, that sub could launch a full-scale atomic attack on any city on the eastern seaboard.
Exactly my reasoning, sir.
And what makes you so darn pleased about it? Not only has an enemy force succeeded in capturing our first atomic submarine, we now learn they have taken along the greatest single weapon the United States Navy owns.
And could thus demolish any city on the eastern seaboard.
So, Commander Richards, you darn well better explain yourself.
Admiral, the captors of the X-915 pulled off one of the greatest coups in military history. Wouldn't you think be satisfied to let it go at that?
Please continue, Commander.
However, this enemy went to the added risk of stealing a shipment of atomic launching rockets. Now, why?
Why?
Why take that extra gamble unless they had plans to use it?
I'm beginning to see your point, Commander.
If the captors of the X-915 merely wanted the sub and were planning to make a run for it, they'd have accomplished it. But they included in their plans our atomic rockets. Admiral Carruthers, it's my guess they're going to use those rockets in the near future. Say, today.
I'll go along with that reasoning, Commander. Let's get to work.
1300 hours, 3 April 1952. Admiral Carruthers and I studied the charts of the Atlantic coast. We agreed the logical target for atomic attack would be the city of New York. Figuring the effective range of the sub's atomic rockets at 100 miles, we then sketched in the launching area the sub would have to use. Once that was established, there remained one simple detail. Stop those rockets from ever leaving the sub's deck. Admiral Carruthers, lately of Inuitok, Iwo Jima truck in the Philippines, had a plan.
All right, Commander. We've settled on the site of their attack. That becomes our bullseye. Around the bullseye, we draw a circle 10 miles out, like this. Then another circle, another 10 miles. And still another. Until the outer circle around the bullseye measures 100-mile radius.
In other words, sir, our outer circle is out of the atomic sub's radar range.
Exactly. Now, calculating their speed and course, they should arrive at point bullseye, the center, just about the time we're able to complete a ring of ships 100 miles out.
With the X-915 in the center. Except if we close in, sir, the sub will submerge and escape under us.
We won't close in.
I beg your pardon, sir?
We'll send one ship in for the bullseye, alone. The sub will pick up contact.
Yes, I'm beginning to understand. They'll figure it for a stray vessel, not enough of a threat to frighten them. But it would force them to shift their position before launching their rocket.
Right. And it also forces them to travel submerged. That negates the 100-mile radar. Next, we send in another lone ship. Sub shifts position again. It's another segment of our circle. Then we send in still another ship. We're constantly narrowing their corridor for attack.
And when they break surface in the last remaining segment to fire their rockets, we're surrounding them.
We hope to God we are, Commander. Hello, Red Dog One. Hello, Red Dog One. This is Pierpoint Five. Over.
Hello, Pierpoint Five. This is Red Dog One. Over.
Discontinue search plan Able. I repeat, discontinue search plan Able. Over.
Pierpoint Five, this is Red Dog One. Would you repeat your last transmission? Over.
Red Dog One, this is Pierpoint Five. I repeat, discontinue your present search plan. The following plan supersedes all previous orders. It is to be executed immediately following this transmission. I repeat.
The admiral, with the patience of a man who knew his job, began dictating to his task force commander the base search pattern they were to follow. For 5 minutes, he gave facts and figures that he explained the purpose of his new plan. If his conversation was terse to the point of being salty, then it was still more temperate than the situation might have called for. By 1600, the plan was in effect. The admiral clicked off his radio transmitter and we stared at each other. We had to pray for one thing. That whoever had captured the X-915 would now proceed to the launching area, and once there, attempt to destroy
the city of New York. The sun was low outside the Admiral's office. The sun was low outside the city of New York. Sundown was made for submarines. It is their witching hour, their debut, their time for attack.
Coffee, Commander?
Thank you, sir.
What time is it?
5:20, sir.
Beautiful sunset.
Yes, sir.
Used to seem like this off Eniwetok.
Pacific, that's where you have the sunsets.
Linden served in the Pacific, sir.
Linden? Oh.
More coffee, Admiral?
Commander, what happened to Chief Engineer Linden? Captain Unger. Unger was a classmate of mine at the Academy. He didn't sell out.
None of them sold out, sir. They were Shanghai. You can bet on it.
And they're all aboard that sub right now. Linden and Unger and a lot of good men. The sub, it's our job to sink.
5, this is Red Dog 1. Come in, please.
Well, that's Captain Stevens. They should be at the launching point now.
Pierpoint 5, Red Dog 1. Go ahead. Over.
Pierpoint 5, we have completed the ring. I repeat, we have completed the ring. Over.
Red Dog 1, Pierpoint 5, have you sent in your first messenger?
Pierpoint 5, this is Red Dog 1. Roger. Over.
Red Dog 1, proceed with plan. Please advise any contact. Over and out.
The Admiral sat down behind his chart-cluttered desk, the wind-lined stains of his face more noticeable now, and together we waited.
Pierpoint 5, I'm sending in second messenger, ring closing. No contact as yet. Over and out.
Together we waited. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 3 minutes.
Sending in third messenger, closing to a bullseye. No contact. Over and out.
One by one, the single ships were slicing across the big target we'd drawn on our chart. Each ship slicing in closer toward the launching area, forcing the enemy we'd never seen to change plans, change positions, yet not frightening him enough to make him forget his attack.
0.5, Red Dog 1, sending in 7th messenger. No contact as yet. Closing within 10 miles of bullseye. I repeat, no contact.
In one way, that's good, Commander. At least we can feel certain the X-915 hasn't circled.
Well, we're safe from a radar, then. Her sound range is 10,000 yards.
And I'm going to order the task force to patrol that range. Red Dog 1, take position 5 miles from bullseye. I repeat, take position 5 miles from bullseye. Over.
Pierpoint 5, this is Red Dog 1. Okay, Skipper, but that's as close as we can get if we miss.
Oh, darn it, we aren't going to miss. Close in.
Aye, aye, sir.
And report to me every minute.
Yes, sir, we're closing in. Over and out.
Stevens is worried.
I don't blame him, sir.
He's only worried. I'm scared. Suppose the sub headed for Siberia.
Then we're out of luck anyway.
0.5, closing to 10,000 yards. No contact. Destroyer group... 0.5. Destroyer group off by Port Bow has sighted enemy. I repeat, destroyer group has sighted enemy. The sub is surfacing. 0.5, do you hear me? Over.
Red Dog 1, I hear you. Over.
Enemy has surfaced. Destroyer group opening fire. Bombers coming in. Bombers making attack. Bombers still surface. 0.5.
Red Dog 1. Red Dog 1, come in, please. Red Dog 1, this is 0.5. Come in, please. Red Dog 1, are you receiving me?
0.5, this is Red Dog 1. I am receiving you. Air Force and destroyer groups have attacked. The X-915 is sinking. I repeat, X-915 is sinking. Proceeding to pick up survivors. Over.
Red Dog 1, this is Pierpoint 5. Well done. Over and out.
1000 hours, 4 April 1952. Task Force Able reported into Admiral Carruthers. Seaman with brilliant naval records. All eight had been living and working within Naval Base Charlie for 6 months. And what of the Steinberg periscope? Why had they sabotaged it? The answer was, they had not. Just as the lab technicians told us, the cable had broken from strain. A manufacturer's mistake. A mistake that brought Action 80 onto the scene. A mistake that may have saved the city of New York. And in his excitement, Admiral Carruthers handed me a cigar. End of report, transmitted once to
Action 80.
The broadcast you have just heard was scientific fiction. Any similarity to persons living or dead was purely coincidental.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Fear by Guy de Maupassant. We went up on deck after dinner. Before us, the Mediterranean lay without a ripple and shimmered in the moonlight. The great ship glided on, casting upward to the star-studded sky a long serpent of black smoke. Behind us, the dazzling white water, stirred by the rapid progress of the heavy bark and beaten by the propeller, foamed, seemed to writhe, gave off so much brilliancy that one could have called it boiling moonlight. There were six or eight of us silent with admiration and gazing toward faraway Africa, whither we were going. The commandant, who was smoking a cigar with us, brusquely resumed the conversation begun at dinner. "Yes, I was afraid then. My ship remained for 6 hours on that rock, beaten by the wind and with a great hole in the side. Luckily, we were picked up toward evening by an English coaler which sighted us." Then a tall man of sunburned face and grave demeanor, one of those men who have evidently traveled unknown in faraway lands, whose calm eye seems to preserve in its depths something of the foreign scenes it has observed, a man that you are sure is impregnated with courage, spoke for the first time. "You say, Commandant, that you were afraid. I beg to disagree with you. You are in error as to the meaning of the word and the nature of the sensation that you experienced. An energetic man is never afraid in the presence of urgent danger. He is excited, aroused, full of anxiety. But fear is something quite different." The Commandant laughed and answered, "Bah, I assure you that I was afraid." Then the man of the tanned countenance addressed us deliberately as follows. "Permit me to explain. Fear, and the boldest men may feel fear, is something horrible, an atrocious sensation, a sort of decomposition of the soul, a terrible spasm of brain and heart, the very memory of which brings a shudder of anguish. But when one is brave, he feels it neither under fire nor in the presence of sure death, nor in the face of any well-known danger. It springs up under certain abnormal conditions, under certain mysterious influences in the presence of vague peril. Real fear is a sort of reminiscence of fantastic terror of the past. A man who believes in ghosts and imagines he sees a specter in the darkness must feel terror in all its horror. As for me, I was overwhelmed with fear in broad daylight about 10 years ago, and again one December night last winter. Nevertheless, I have gone through many dangers, many adventures which seemed to promise death. I have often been in battle. I have been left for dead by thieves. In America, I was condemned as an insurgent to be hanged, and off the coast of China have been thrown into the sea from the deck of a ship. Each time I thought I was lost, I at once decided upon my course of action without regret or weakness. That is not fear. I have felt it in Africa, and yet it is a child of the north. The sunlight banishes it like the mist. Consider this fact, gentlemen. Among the Orientals, life has no value. Resignation is natural. The nights are clear and empty of the somber spirit of unrest which haunts the brain in cooler lands. In the Orient, panic is known, but not fear. Well then, here is the incident that befell me in Africa. I was crossing the great sands to the south of Onargla. It is one of the most curious districts in the world. you have seen the solid, continuous sand of the endless ocean strands. Well, imagine the ocean itself turned to sand in the midst of a storm. Imagine a silent tempest with motionless billows of yellow dust. They are high as mountains, these uneven, varied surges, rising exactly like unchained billows, but still larger, and stratified like watered silk. On this wild, silent, and motionless sea, the consuming rays of the tropical sun are poured piteously and directly. You have to climb these streaks of red-hot ash, descend again on the other side, climb again, climb, climb without halt, without repose, without shade. The horses cough, sink to their knees, and slide down the sides of these remarkable hills. We were a couple of friends, followed by 8 Spahis and 4 camels with their drivers. We were no longer talking, overcome by heat, fatigue, and a thirst such as had produced this burning desert. Suddenly one of our men uttered a cry. We all halted, surprised by the unsolved phenomenon known only to travelers in these trackless wastes. Somewhere near us, in an indeterminable direction, a drum was rolling. The mysterious drum of the sands. It was beating distinctly, now with greater resonance and again feebler, ceasing, then resuming its uncanny roll. The Arabs, terrified, stared at one another, and one said in his language, "Death is upon us." As he spoke, my companion, my friend, almost my brother, dropped from his horse, falling face downward on the sand, overcome by a sunstroke. And for 2 hours, while I tried in vain to save him, this weird drum filled my ears with its monotonous, intermittent, and incomprehensible tone. And I felt lay hold of my bones fear, real fear, hideous fear, in the presence of this beloved corpse, in this hole scorched by the sun, surrounded by 4 mountains of sand, and 200 leagues from any French settlement, while echo assailed our ears with his furious drumbeat. On that day I realized what fear was, but since then I have had another, and still more vivid experience. The commandant interrupted the speaker. "I beg your pardon, but what was the drum?" The traveler replied, "I cannot say. No one knows." Our officers are often surprised by this singular noise and attribute it generally to the echo produced by a hail of grains of sand blown by the winds against the dry and brittle leaves of weeds, for it has always been noticed that the phenomenon occurs in proximity to little plants burned by the sun and hard as parchment. This sound seems to have been magnified, multiplied, and swelled beyond measure in its progress through the valleys of sand, and the drum, therefore, might be considered a sort of sound mirage. Nothing more. But I did not know that until later. I shall proceed to my second instance. It was last winter in a forest of the northeast of France. The sky was so overcast that night came 2 hours earlier than usual. My guide was a peasant who walked beside me along the narrow road, under the vault of fir trees, through which the wind in its fury howled. Between the treetops, I saw the fleeting clouds which seemed to hasten, as if to escape some object of terror. Sometimes, in a fierce gust of wind, the whole forest bowed in the same direction, with a groan of pain, and a chill laid hold of me, despite my rapid pace and heavy clothing. We were to sup and sleep at an old gamekeeper's house not much farther on. I had come out for hunting. My guide sometimes raised his eyes and murmured, "Ugly weather." Then he told me about the people among whom we were to spend the night. The father had killed a poacher 2 years before, and since then had been gloomy and behaved as though haunted by a memory. His 2 sons were married and lived with him. The darkness was profound. I could see nothing before me nor around me, and the mass of overhanging interlaced trees rubbed together, filling the night with an incessant whispering. Finally I saw a light, and soon my companion was knocking upon a door. Sharp women's voices answered us, then a man's voice, a choking voice, asked, "Who goes there?" My guide gave his name. We entered and beheld a memorable picture. An old man with white hair, wild eyes, and a loaded gun in his hands, stood waiting for us in the middle of the kitchen, while 2 stalwart youths, armed with axes, guarded the door. In the somber corners, I distinguished two women kneeling with faces to the wall. Matters were explained, and the old man stood his gun against the wall, at the same time ordering that a room be prepared for me. Then, as the women did not stir, "Look you, monsieur," said he, "2 years ago this night I killed a man, and last year he came back to haunt me. I expect him again tonight." Then he added in a tone that made me smile, "And so we are somewhat excited." I reassured him as best I could, happy to have arrived on that particular evening and to witness this superstitious terror. I told stories and almost succeeded in calming the whole household. Near the fireplace slept an old dog, mustached and almost blind, with his head between his paws, such a dog as reminds you of people you have known. Outside, the raging storm was beating against the little house, and suddenly, through a small pane of glass, a sort of peep window placed near the door, I saw, in a brilliant flash of lightning, a whole mass of trees thrashed by the wind. In spite of my efforts, I realized that terror was laying hold of these people, and each time that I ceased to speak, all ears listened for distant sounds. Annoyed at these foolish fears, I was about to retire to my bed, when the old gamekeeper suddenly leapt from his chair, seized his gun, and stammered wildly, "There he is! There he is! I hear him!" The two women again sank upon their knees in the corner and hid their faces, while the sons took up the axes. I was going to try to pacify them once more, when the sleeping dog awakened suddenly, and raising his head and stretching his neck, looked at the fire with his dim eyes, and uttered one of those mournful howls which make travelers shudder in the darkness and solitude of the country. All eyes were focused upon him now as he rose upon his front feet as though haunted by a vision, and began to howl at something invisible, unknown, and doubtless horrible, for he was bristling all over. The gamekeeper with livid face cried, "He scents him! He scents him! He was there when I killed him!" The two women, terrified, began to wail in concert with the dog. In spite of myself, cold chills ran down my spine. This vision of the animal at such a time and place, in the midst of these startled people, was something frightful to witness. Then for an hour the dog howled without stirring. He howled as though in the anguish of a nightmare, and fear, horrible fear, came over me. Fear of what? How can I say? It was fear, and that is all I know. We remained motionless and pale, expecting something awful to happen. Our ears were strained, and our hearts beat loudly while the slightest noise startled us. Then the beast began to walk around the room, sniffing at the walls and growling constantly. His maneuvers were driving us mad. Then the countryman, who brought me thither in a paroxysm of rage, seized the dog, and carrying him to a door which opened into a small court, thrust him forth. The noise was suppressed, and we were left plunged in a silence still more terrible. Then suddenly we all started. Someone was gliding along the outside wall toward the forest. Then he seemed to be feeling of the door with a trembling hand. Then for 2 minutes nothing was heard, and we almost lost our minds. Then he returned, still feeling along the wall, and scratched lightly upon the door as a child might do with his fingernails. Suddenly, a face appeared behind the glass of the peep window, a white face with eyes shining like those of the cat tribe. A sound was heard, an indistinct, plaintive murmur. Then there was a formidable burst of noise in the kitchen. The old gamekeeper had fired, and the two sons at once rushed forward and barricaded the window with the great table, reinforcing it with the buffet. I swear to you that at the shock of the gun's discharge, which I did not expect, such an anguish laid hold of my heart, my soul, and my very body, that I felt myself about to fall, about to die from fear. We remained there until dawn, unable to move, in short, seized by an indescribable numbness of the brain. No one dared to remove the barricade until a thin ray of sunlight appeared through a crack in the back room. At the base of the wall and under the window, we found the old dog lying dead, his skull shattered by a ball. He had escaped from the little court by digging a hole under a fence. The dark-visaged man became silent. Then he added, "And yet on that night I incurred no danger. But I should rather again pass through all the hours in which I have confronted the most terrible perils than the 1 minute when that gun was discharged at the bearded head in the window." Recording by Alan Winterout. Boomcoach.blogspot.com.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of the so-called dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions, and we're going to fade off here into music. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody that you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You know, it's not like I know what I'm doing here, so if you have any suggestions or you just want to tell me where to go, feel free. If you have an old radio show that you remember that's in this vein that we do here, tell me about it. I'll see if I can find it and play it. I'd also like to encourage you to visit the website, which is where the show notes are kept. The website, not surprisingly, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is one word, no space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmission. Just Night Transmissions. Okay, well, I'm going to shut up now. I think I mentioned before that my mother always told me that if you don't think too good, you shouldn't think too much. I've always taken that to heart. And I've extended that to think that perhaps if you don't host too good, you shouldn't host too much. I hope you won't hold that against me and will continue to drop by and listen to these old radio programs.
Dreamed I saw a silver spaceship flying. the yellow haze of the sun, there were children crying and colors flying all around. People will say we're in love. Don't sigh and gaze at me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't stop collecting things. Give me my rose and my glove. Sweetheart, they're suspecting things. People will say we're in love. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't sigh and gaze at me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't start collecting things. Give me my rose and my glove. Sweetheart, they're suspecting things. People will say we're in love, so in love. People will say we're in love.
ladies adrift in a foreign land, singing on issues both humble and grand. A decade flew past her, and there on the page, she read that the prince had returned to the stage. Hovering near treacherous water, a friend saw her drifting and caught her. Unguarded fantasies flying too far, memories tumbling like sweets from a jar. And take me down to the harbor now. Grapes of the summer are low on the bough. Ghosts of my history will follow me there, and the winds of the old days will blow through my on an undying ember. It doesn't take much to remember those eloquent songs from the good old days that set us to marching with banners ablaze. But reporters, there's no sense in prying. Our blue-eyed son's been denying history. The 60s are over, so set him free. And take me down to the harbor now. Grapes of the summer are low on the bough. Ghosts of my history will follow me there, and the winds of the old days will blow. Self-righteousness will not budge. Singer, savior, it was